Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I am Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here once a week to talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. And we gather here at the studios of KHOI in beautiful downtown Ames. This is a community radio station.
We are glad to be here with you, and we hope you all are warm and well, fighting our way through February here. Yes, spring will come. I just know it will. That's a promise. Thank you, Donna. Well, joining us today at our kitchen table is Ben
Hawk.
Welcome, Ben.
Hey, it's good to be back.
Yeah, Ben is just handy. He comes on and he knows so much about so many different things. I've learned a lot from Ben, and Ben showed up at my kitchen door last week with catfish, and these were amazing looking fish, and oh my God. So he had a 5-gallon bucket, and the fish were so big that they were kind of sitting on their tails, but their little faces were way up, shooting off the top of the 5-gallon bucket. These were big fish, folks. And I said, catfish, I said, Ben. Oh, boy, catfish. And he said, I'll clean them for you. I said, thank you. Thank you. So he's here to tell us how to take care of those things. Ben, talk to us about catfish.
Yeah, well, I guess a lot of folks don't usually expect to be fishing for catfish in the winter. You know, I grew up fishing along the Mississippi River as a kid up in the northeast corner of Iowa. And we'd always catch them in the heat of the summer, you know, throw a worm out on the bottom. And that's kind of the classic, you know, my favorite style of fishing, throw out a hook and wait, you know, kind of just watch the river go by. And, you know, growing up ice fishing, you know, we'd always target panfish, you know, bluegills and crappies and the occasional largemouth bass. And just the last couple of years, I've kind of learned how to dial in some of these other species because their behaviors are just different, you know, just like we're, you know, in the end of the winter blues, we're kind of in a hunkered down period, you know, the fish are also behaving much differently than they are when it's warm. So I got a chance to go out with a friend of mine, and they were catching a species of fish called a wiper. And a wiper is a hybrid between a striped bass, which is like an oceanic river kind of mixed fish, and then a white bass, which is like a, you know, a much smaller version of that. So they've hybridized these and released them into Iowa waters. And they grow really fast. They fight really strong. They're pretty good eating fish. And we heard they were catching them in this really deep water, you know, 40 feet of water out at Ada Hayden. And that's the lake there here in Ames. And I decided, you know, well, I've caught fish in really deep water. I've caught wipers in really deep water in the Mississippi in the winter. And I figured we'd go out and give it a shot out there. So there's a lot of different ways to ice fish these days. You know, you can do the old school, you know, drop a line down, find the bottom, bring it up a little bit, and just kind of go that way. But there are all these amazing electronics available.
Oh,
and,
no.
You know, some of them, yeah, how complicated can we make things, right? It's like we could sous vide a steak, or we could throw it on the grill until it feels like the soft part of your hand, right? And so a friend of mine has this amazing 3D imagery, and you can basically put this thing down and you'll be able to tell almost to the species of fish what it is.
You drop it in the water in the hole in the ice?
Yeah, you set this little transducer down there, and it's probably technology we had in, you know, World War II running submarines, you know. We probably have better stuff in our fishing tackle today, you know. And we're able to see these big schools of bait moving around, and then you can see fish coming in and taking swoops at them and, you know, getting things to eat. And then you can see little things scuttling along the bottom. And this is in 40 feet of water. You know, it's amazing to see how far this stuff has come. So, my buddy hooks into a really good fish, and we're like, oh man, we're on these wipers, you know, and he gets this thing all the way up to the top, and it's like an 8-pound channel cat. And we're both just blown away. You know, the hole that we use for ice fishing, you know, they're either 4 or 5 or 6 or sometimes 8 inches. The hole was too small to get the fish through it.
I knew it. So, I knew it. This is a fish story. Okay, keep going.
Got plenty of them for you. And so we had to get the auger out and try to drill a hole right next to the other hole. And we ended up cutting the line and the fish got away. So... of course, the biggest fish of the day was the first one that we hooked, and it managed to escape. But, you know, seeing that there are catfish down there, I learned a couple techniques over the years to try to target winter catfish. So what I usually do is I drop all the way down to the bottom. I use a small jig or something just kind of heavy to get me down there. And I bait it with a dead minnow that I've kind of cut open a little bit, you know, to get the juices flowing. You know, some of those catfish, they have those whiskers, they smell really well down there. And cold water doesn't really move smells around that much. So anything you can really do to aid the process is good. And I've learned that they're also kind of finicky biters. So you lower this minnow all the way down to the bottom and you bring it up off the bottom just maybe an inch or two, just to where you barely have tension on the line. And then you just forget that you're fishing. You just sit back and talk with your friends and try to ignore what's going on, because a lot of people like to just sit there and jig the pole and try to get the fish excited. And sometimes they're not into that. So basically the game is just sit there and wait. And they'll bite just ever so lightly and then set the hook and reel them up. It's as simple as that.
And make sure your hole is big enough. Oh, but I had no idea that there would be something as big as this. You had more than one. These catfish in Adahit, like you said, I thought they were Mississippi fish. What in the world are they doing in an old refurbished quarry lake? How did they get there?
Well, they're native to Iowa, so they're going to be in any of our waterways, you know, that are deep enough to, you know, pretty much stay flowing year round. You know, Iowa Creek has them, you know, when the water comes up in the spring and summer, the skunk is full of them. And, you know, just like, you know, people have farm ponds, they stock them with fish. I imagine Ada Hayden was stocked with some fish originally. Catfish reproduce really well in Iowa waters. They don't have as high of a requirement for like high water quality because the state isn't exactly known for that. We have very little natural reproduction of walleyes in our rivers, especially the Des Moines. You know, any walleye that's caught, you know, chances are it was stocked as a fingerling, you know, a very small fish by the hard work of our Department of Natural Resources. And just like, you know, the rivers come up and flood, fish can get swept into Ada Hayden, because there is an outflow, and fish can also, go from, the skunk into Ada Hayden. So there's a fella, who hunts at the property that Lana owns and I live at. And, he was actually fishing down, at the dam, just east of Ada Hayden last summer, and caught 3 rainbow trout in the middle of the summer at that dam. And rainbow trout usually need really, really cold water. So if there's something I've learned in Iowa, it's to not be surprised by what we encounter here. You know, nature always seems to find a way, even in a landscape like ours.
That's good news. Question. Some of these fish species you said, the trout and the walleyes are relatively rare. Are you supposed to throw those back, or can anything catch as fair game, or what?
Well, whenever someone talks about that kind of stuff, I usually look to the DNR, to the regulations, and I say, well, if they're making regulations that allow us to keep fish, I'm going to believe that the biologists on staff are making the best decisions. And I guess, you know, I'm never going to say that a person who is out fishing shouldn't keep a fish. I think that can be for anyone to make their own decision on, as long as you're following the law.
Very good. After all, that is amazing news. I had no idea that that sort of fish were available. And like I mentioned, big enough that you had to enlarge the hole. That's a good fish story to start.
I want to know how thick the ice is.
Oh, right now the ice is thick enough to drive a truck on. I mean, it's probably 14 or 15 inches in some places, probably more in others. It's
that's what they always say, Donna.
So the melting that we see on a warm day like it's going to be today is just superficial soup on the top or something?
Yep, just up top, you know, and with these cold nights, you know, it refreezes and everything down below is really nice and solid. You know, late season, when you get into late ice, the fish start behaving differently because they're getting ready to spawn. You know, the day length is changing, you know, biology is happening. The ice can change. So, you know, it can get more pitted and like it can get more full of water. You know, you'll drill a hole late season and water comes like rushing into the hole as you're drilling it. So there's definite ways to make sure, you know, you can be safe when you're getting out on ice. The best way is to carry a spud bar. It's just a big steel rod, you know, and you just, as you're walking, you just use that to hit the ice in front of you, to see if it's sturdy enough to either chip through or not. And, as you practice, you know, you learn how to read your situation.
Very good. Very good. Well, let's talk about, since this is the Donalena kitchen, let's talk about how to attack this catfish. First off, when I said catfish, Donna didn't have a very good reaction.
Oh, yeah. I like Ben, I grew up near enough the Mississippi to be eating catfish in the summer, a little bit south, more towards the Burlington area. But I don't like catfish. I'll eat almost anything. But based on my experience in adolescent of eating, you know, going out on the sandbars and fishing and catching them and, you know, having the picnic right there, they taste like mud.
So, Ben, you cleaned this catfish and gave it to me, and it was really, really good.
Lana says they're good. So what did you do?
So, when I lived in Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, I had the opportunity to work for a commercial fisherman there, a local legend by the name of Mike Valley of Valley Fish and Cheese, and Mike has been, comes from a long line of river folks, and he himself has been a commercial fisherman for, you know, over 30 years. And he runs a smoked fish shop off of the main drag there in town. And Mike has a lot of very creative ways that he's learned to process these fish to make them good for his own consumption, but also marketing them to people who normally wouldn't think that these fish are any good. So I guess the first thing that I think of that we have going for us is that it's winter. I always think that winter fish seem to taste a little bit better than summer fish. If they're coming out of cold water, the water quality is a little bit higher. You know, the dissolved nutrients and the runoff things that usually happen in Iowa. The ground is pretty much frozen, so we're running on a lot of groundwater. The fish just seem to taste better when they come out of cold, cleaner water. And I would say, first off, that's a good way to start off attributing some of the taste. Now, the neat thing about catfish is they've kind of got three different main pieces of meat that I would get off of them. So just like any fish that you would normally clean, you have the fillets, and those run from right about behind the gill down the back towards the tail, and you can get a pretty good size piece of meat off of that. Now when I fillet a catfish, I'll take the main fillet off, and then you've still got the skin on. And one of the things that I always do with catfish is when I'm filleting the skin off of the fish, I always ride the knife a little high, because there's a layer of darker meat that is in between the white meat of the fillet and the skin. And if I ride that knife a little higher, I lose a little bit of meat, but I also get rid of that fattier, oilier, more gamey tasting. Not saying that in a negative way, because people love catfish that really taste like catfish too. But if you ride that knife a little high, you can get rid of that stuff towards the skin. And then when you flip the fillet over, that piece of skin that you just took off, and you look at it, there's a thing called a lateral line on it on a fish. And that's how they take in a lot of their nerves. They can tell where their body is. They can tell if kids are throwing rocks in the water. It sends a little vibration to this lateral line. And along that line, there's also another strip of dark meat. And it's just about, you know, as big as around as a pencil, and runs the whole length from the gill plate back to the tail. And you can just kind of notch out a little V and pull out that little pencil strip sized piece of meat. And then you've got a beautiful white fillet that is ready for this next part of the process that I'll talk about. But I got to talk about the other two cuts of meat first. The second cut of meat, after you get the fillets out, is the belly. And the belly is probably my favorite piece of the catfish. You do it very similarly. You just kind of cut that meat out from the bottom as the fillets are left. You've got kind of a triangle-shaped piece down there. And then you can fillet the skin off of the outside. And there's kind of a membrane on the inside as well. And you can fillet that off. And you've got these two little beautiful pieces, these two little medallions of meat that are just... I think what I like most about them is the texture. The texture is more like chicken than it is like fish. It almost tears like it. It holds up like a grilled chicken sandwich, and it just really lends itself to throwing on the grill or what have you. Okay, and the third part of meat that the fish that is one of my favorites is the cheek. And I like to call the cheeks like Iowa scallops. If you get a big enough... if you get a big enough catfish, you make a cut that kind of goes from behind the eye, around the back of the cheek, towards the gill plate. You need to do some creative cutlery, you know, get a nice sharp knife. And as you learn where the bones are, and you learn how to get that nice, that piece out in one nice structure. And on a really big fish, you know, it can almost look like a scallop when you get it out of there. And the texture of it is fairly similar too. It's nice and firm. It's not mushy, anything else like that. So, okay, we've got our three cuts of meat. Now, what I learned from Mike Valley to use for several different kinds of river fish is that you want to get your fish in the sink, put the bottom in it. So you're going to be filling the sink with water, and you want to fill it with warm to hot water. I couldn't exactly tell you what temperature it would be. You don't want to cook the fish. You want to easily be able to have your hand in there. You want it to be above warm, you know, just like, barely above.
Bath water, warmer than bath water.
Yeah, or like since the bath water.
Or baby bottle temperature, you know.
Yeah, there we go.
To warm the milk, you shake it on your wrist and it has to feel a certain way.
Yeah. That's it. Okay. Good.
That sounds pretty good. Yeah. And you'll figure it out as you go. So get your fillets in there, turn your water on to that temperature, and then just start agitating the heck out of those fish. Like, you want to get your fingers in there and you want to really rifle them up. And as you do that, as the sink fills with water, you'll notice all these little particulates kind of come out, you know, those little bits of flesh and whatever that were. And you'll also notice that the water will foam to an extent. And the way I've been taught is it gets rid of some of these oils that are in the fish that attribute to some of this river taste. And I'll do that rinse 3 or 4 times with that temperature of water. And you'll notice that the fish will turn a little bit brighter white. They'll start to curl a little bit. And some of that's from the warmer temperature. It'll actually start to change the protein structure. But as it does that, it starts to give off some of those fats. And you give it a good 3 or 4 rinses, changes the water until you don't really see that foam anymore. And then you have your, and then once you get that final drain, you turn that water on as cold as you can. And then you put them in that ice cold water and you let them sit in there for about, I don't know, 5 or 10 minutes just to really firm them up.
To stop the cooking process, basically, the heat thing. Yeah.
Yeah, there it is. And once you've done that, you know, I guess I usually just drive around and see how many bags of fillets I can drop off to friends. And if not, I put them in a and if not, I put them in a Ziploc with enough water to completely cover the fish. Because if you just freeze a fish fillet in the in a Ziploc, it's going to get freezer burned really fast.
Well, excellent tips. Yeah. Wow.
That's great. I have to testify that I was a recipient of one of these catfish. And since you pointed out the fillet, the belly, and the cheeks, yes. Now, they tasted the same and they tasted good to me, all of them. But yes, the texture is very different and the cheeks are wonderful. I am familiar with trout cheeks. And these were maybe not trout cheeks, but very, very nice. And it's so nice to know that they're all part of one fish.
Okay, so how big of a catfish do you need to be able to fillet it like that then?
Well, you can get bellies and fillets off of really any size catfish. You know, I usually don't keep catfish that are below about a foot. And then I also don't usually keep catfish that are, you know, more than 5 or 8 pounds. Although those big fish do eat really, really well as well. The cheeks, you probably want to go for some bigger fish. If you're trying to get cheeks off of a 12-inch mm-hmm. catfish, you're not going to have much there. Although it is really good practice to where you do get like a 3 to 5 to 8 pounder. It's a good experiment in how to make that work.
Wow, very good.
So how, maybe what I should say is I don't eat farmed catfish then.
Maybe. Well, or people that didn't know how to cook them.
Well, my experience with farm fish, and I must say, it's based on, you know, people have tried to give me or sell me tilapia for years and other farm fish, and somehow I just don't like, it tastes like dirt. Mostly.
This didn't taste like dirt. It tasted like a fish. I rather enjoyed it.
Wow.
Very good. So this is good.
So Ben, what's your opinion on farmed catfish then?
Well, I think it's a creative way to use some resources that are available. But I also look to Iowa waters and I think that it makes more sense to use the resources that we do have. You know, if our environment can provide these things for us, I think we should take advantage of them and harvest them in a sustainable way, because that's what people have done here for tens of thousands of years. Now, I guess folks will also argue that, you know, maybe fish out of Iowa waters have, you know, consumption advisories related to them. You know, women and children, you know, childbearing age, you know, every state has their own rules and regulations that they set for the safe levels of certain heavy metals and other things in fish. And, well, you know, some folks would say, well, yeah, you don't want to eat too much fish out of Iowa waters. It's bad for you. And I say, well, yeah, sure, but maybe we should focus on cleaning up Iowa waters instead of supporting an industry that's farming fish in a foreign country.
because we're drinking that water too.
Yes, we are.
And I also have a sense of pride about it too. Like, you know, it's what we have. And even if, you know, in small amounts, you know, you can use the science to know that it's not going to hurt you. But I want to be able to interact with my environment, and I don't want to be afraid of some things, you know. So I'm going to take the chance.
Good. Yeah. Good. Well, okay. At this point, I have to bring up Lana has an ice fishing joke. Would you please tell your ice fishing joke? This is a very Wisconsin joke.
All right. I have an ice fishing joke. Now, since I'm a gardener, this kind of fits in too. You know, the allium family, the onions, the shallots, the leeks, they're a really handy vegetable. And in this case, I'm going to teach you how to catch a fish with leeks. And this is an ice fishing application of catching fish, because it only works in the winter ice fishing. Okay. So you're out on the lake and you drill your hole, like you said, in the ice. Now you've got to take your leeks. I'd say 4 or 5 really good leeks, the kind of lots of green tops, the white stems, and you lay those leeks carefully around the hole till they're all touching. They make kind of this bouquet around the hole. And then you open a beer, or should I say you open another beer, and then you pour a whole can of beer down that hole in between those leeks, and then you sit back and wait, like you say. You just sit back and wait. And then the fish is down there. And when the fish comes up to take a leak, you grab them.
That's a Wisconsin joke.
That's probably one of the only jokes I know. So we'll take this opportunity to say this is KHOY and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. This is Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. A little note about that tune. I've been waiting to play that tune on this show for a long time. That one is called Nail That Catfish to a Tree. It was written by a musician from the Chicago area. His name is Steve Rosen. And oh, way back in the last century, I used to dance to him and his band. He used to be with the Chicago Barn Dance folks over there. And his band that played that catfish song is the Volo Bog Trotters. So just a shout out to them for a very appropriate sort of thing. Yes, the Nail Like Catfish to a Tree tune. So we are talking to Ben Hoch, and we're talking about more fish stuff. Oh, I want to mention, it's not just catfish that has a bad rap. You and I were talking about this last week. Ben, you said that, people just don't like a certain kind of fish, or they don't like a certain kind of mammal, or food prejudice is just, I think, all over. We all have our food prejudices.
Yeah, definitely. And I guess since we're on the topic of fish, you know, I can mention a couple other species. You know, people usually refer to them as rough fish, but things like carp or buffalo. They're really bony. You can't really fillet them like you normally would. When folks are trying to catch walleyes or some other game fish, they'll end up catching these. And a lot of folks just stick up their nose to them. When historically, you know, these have been kind of the fish that were always there to be caught, were always in good abundance, and were great food sources to have around and still are. So I really love, baking, buffalo fish. They're really bony, but they've got a beautiful white flaky meat. Tastes very good. Carp, I really love smoking carp. And when I get done smoking a carp, you know, that thing basically tastes like ham. I mean, the meat is dark, it's fatty and sweet. I'd take it over a walleye any day, when I'm be sitting down for a meal. And, speaking of time on the Mississippi, about 10 years ago, I took a trip canoeing the whole Mississippi. When I ended up down in the South, I got to talking to some folks and, learned a couple of their traditions. And folks I met down there, at least when they grew up, were in the habit of catching possums and raccoons and keeping them in little cages on the side of the house, feeding them food scraps and canned corn and getting them nice and fattened up for holiday meals like Thanksgiving and Christmas. And, you know, a lot of this stuff, I think the food prejudices come from, you know, how easily available, you know, our foods are, you know, and also how we've bred certain traits out of food. So when I'm doing a wild edibles class and I show someone a wild edible plant and they nip a leaf off and they say, "Ooh, that's bitter." I look at them and I say, "Well, yeah, but I'd usually say it as, ooh, that's bitter." You know, we've kind of accustomed ourselves to to be comfortable with these more softer, laid back, specifically sweet or salty or mild, when so many other cultures have embraced
bitter
these.
Bitter is one of the five taste sensations, and bitter is usually good for your digestion because it stimulates the gastric juices. So it is something we should be eating just because we need to get used to eating it again.
Yeah, also, I 100% agree.
Also, I think food prejudices have a lot to say about how hungry we are. We're pretty
we never get hungry anymore.
Yeah, we're pretty fat and happy here, and if we don't even need to go to the grocery store anymore, we get things Ubered to us. And I think if we were hungry enough, a raccoon or a catfish might taste pretty darn good. Ben, have you ever pickled fish, like ceviche?
Yeah, I've done ceviche. I've done that with freshwater fish. One of the things they always recommend with freshwater fish specifically is that, well, a lot of, even the ceviche that you get at stores is often flash frozen for at least 3 days before you pickle it or before you do the ceviche, because the acidity, even though the fish is cooked through, it doesn't often kill all of the parasites that are in the fish. And you can get tapeworms from up in Minnesota and Wisconsin. There's a case or two or five every year of people getting a tapeworm from improperly pickled northern pike or other different species. Well, now, there's one... Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, well, I was going to say this is true, like, for even for sushi. Tuna, which is certainly not a freshwater fish, is usually frozen before it's then thawed and served on tuna for the same reason, to kill any possible parasites.
I'm glad they're looking out for us. Yeah.
Well, the Japanese, they know a thing or two about fish, I think, so.
Yeah. One of the other fish that I really like to pickle, it's called a quillback. And a quillback looks very similar to a buffalo fish. And if you don't know what a buffalo fish looks like, well, it looks kind of like looks kind of like a carp. It's like a big goldfish, you know, but it's basically a shiny white, you know, color with nice big scales. And its dorsal fin, the one right on top of its back, is where it gets the name quillback from. So there's a long quill that comes off the top that can, you know, depending on the size of the fish, can be, you know, 8 or 10 inches long. And they're a really handsome fish. And they're very bony, you know, just like, you know, other rough fish. But, you know, you fillet them, you get the ribs out, you take them off the skin, off the skin, and then you cut them into pieces. And you've got a lot of little pin bones in there still. But you know, a little bit of freezing and then soaking in your salt vinegar brine for a period of days really just turns them into quite the delicious. I mean, like pickled herring, you know, it's a delicious treat, and it just turns those bones into something you can't even notice anymore.
Oh, so you're kind of eating the bones because they're not because they've softened.
Yeah, the acetic acid.
Yeah,
there it is. And there's another fish that I think of when I think about these. I think of suckers. And suckers are you know, they're shaped like a bottom feeder, you know, a mouth on the bottom. And they're actually indicators of really high water quality. So they eat a lot of aquatic insects, and they've got a really nice firm white meat, but they've also got a lot of pin bones. And I've heard of people, you know, scaling them, getting the big ribs out, and then grinding the whole fillet, bones and all, and then mixing it to make a bit of a fish patty. So you can add like potato or breadcrumbs and herbs, and then fry them just like you would, you know, a fish ball. One of my favorite things to do with suckers is a fella I know who runs a tour boat on the upper Mississippi River out of Marquette and McGregor. He's got a little device that looks like, you know, those old school credit card machines that you would lay your credit card in and then you would, you know, slide it back and forth and it would take a carbon copy of the numbers.
Yeah.
Well, he's got a machine like that, and you scale your sucker, you cut the main rib bones out, and you lay this fillet down, skin side down, in this little device, and it's got a whole bunch of little razor blades that are spaced out at about a tenth or a twelfth of an inch or so. And you just run this chunk, chunk, this little razor blade over the top, and it cuts the fillet down through the meat, but doesn't cut through the skin. And you end up with this beautiful curly fry looking fillet that's just, it's cut through all of your pin bones, and it's given a lot of surface area that you can just coat in some light seasoned flour and then deep fry. And you could walk around all day and tell people that it's walleye, and they would just be tickled to death to eat them.
See, isn't it good to know there's all kinds of good things?
Tricks, good tricks.
And my goodness, I didn't realize there were so many different kind of fish to pick from. I remember a fish, one of these food prejudice things, when I was living in Wisconsin, if one would catch something called a bullhead, one would be ever so chagrined. And as I recall, they were kind of like a little catfish and very unpleasant looking. So I remember throwing them back, but other than that, I don't know too much about them. Are there bullheads here?
There are bullheads here. Yep, they're a native fish to Iowa. They're basically a small, stocky catfish. They get kind of yellow and green colored. They're really bulky. You know, they're kind of a really bulky. Big one can look more like a football than anything else.
They're not your most attractive fish. No.
Yeah. But yeah, there's some ponds I fished around Ankeny where I used to catch them as a kid. They make really good bait for catching much bigger catfish.
See?
And then there's also, there's some folks in Iowa that actually farm bullhead. And there's a big market for folks for eating bullhead, actually.
See.
It's another one of those things that, some people, I think, being raised with it, are continued to be drawn to it, and others run from it, and anyone who has children and tries to teach them about the things that they like, probably can understand how that could go either way.
Right. Well, see, I will open my mind to trying something
all
in
right,
the future.
All right, I'll eat the catfish and Lana will eat the bullhead.
Well, I think we should expand. One thing I remember about bullheads is that when you went to take them off the hook, they've got a thorn, they're a fin off the top. It's got a really sharp thing. You can cut your finger really badly on it. I remember doing that. You gotta watch it out there. They fight back. Yeah.
Yeah. Very
good. Well, any other words of wisdom about fish before we move on to some other things? I don't know. I have a word
yeah,
of wisdom
go for it.
About fish. I just brought this up again because it just works into my theory of how you're supposed to deal with panfish when you're cooking it. And it's the quote from the ancient Chinese philosopher Lao Tzu from the 5th century BC, a little wisdom here. Ruling a large kingdom is like cooking a small fish. Too much handling will spoil it. So, words of wisdom.
Nice.
There it is. Yes.
Yeah, but that does not apply to catfish, apparently.
I think of those as a bit. They're
big
a bit
fish.
Tougher.
Oh, those are big fish.
Tougher. Anyway, nobody.
They can handle it.
You could overcook your fillets too. Gotta be careful. So we'll be back with Ben in a little bit. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen, and you listen to the Donna Lana Kitchen, and you can find out more about this fine radio station and this show at www.khoifm.org. Thank you. We are back. This is the Donna Lena Kitchen. Well, besides all the fun of winter fishing, Ben, you've got, there's other things coming up. You, I want to put a little plug in here. You have something, kind of a all-encompassing website, because you're interested in a lot of different things called Midwest Ephemeral. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, if you're interested in finding it, you can just do a Google search for the name of my maple syrup company, which is called Front Yard Sugar. So there's my plug, shameless self-promotion. Basically, it's a way for me to kind of catalog some of the ways that I move through the seasons of that Iowa has, and how I take advantage of the different natural resources, foodstuffs, educational opportunities that Iowa offers, because there really is something to do in all seasons in this state and in every other state out there as well. So, you know, in summer it's bees, I also cut trees and do educational work related to foraging and, all those other things. This time of year it is getting into maple syrup season.
Ooh, yes.
And a warm day like today really makes me feel like I'm a little bit behind, because the sap is definitely flowing. And it's happening much earlier this year than it has in years past. Maple syrup has been made in North America for thousands of years. You know, native people were making maple sugar and syrup and cooking food and sap and doing all kinds of things long before Europeans got here. And they would usually, if native people were going to produce it and want to store it, they wouldn't store it as syrup like we do. They would take it all the way down to sugar, because it's much more stable in that form. But we like putting it on pancakes and keeping it runny and those kind of things. So we do it a little differently. But this time of year, when the daytime temperatures are above freezing and the nighttime temperatures are below freezing, there is a pressure change that happens. And the pressure outside of a tree is lower than the pressure is on the inside of a tree. Like, these temperature changes cause this to happen. And just like if you cut yourself and you start to bleed, the tree is the same way. You can make a hole in the tree, and because the pressure is greater on the inside of the tree with the temperature changes, it will actually cause sugary sap, basically water with a very low sugar content, maybe 2% sugar, to come out of the tap holes that you make. And that is what is collected and boiled down to make maple syrup.
And, well, I have learned that the ratio of the sugar to the water is pretty low. So tell us how much sap it takes to make syrup.
Well, if you've got really, really sweet sap, it can take 35 to 40 gallons. 35 is about as sweet as it gets, to make 1 gallon of syrup. So you have to reduce it by 40 times to get it down to 1 gallon. Now, that's if you're tapping sugar maples or black maples. If you're tapping box elders or silvers, it can get up to 60 or 70 gallons to make one. Or if you're tapping birch, it can take 120 gallons to make one. Whoa. And they all have a little bit different flavor. You can even tap walnut trees and make a syrup out of walnuts. Now, it doesn't taste like you would expect it to. It tastes very nice. It has a much higher pectin content than other saps, so it has a little bit more of a difficult filtering process. But everyone's just a little unique. This season is a little different. So classically in Iowa, you know, we get this February warm up, but it usually comes around the second week of February, and it lasts maybe a week or 4 or 5 days, you know, and, you know, that top layer of soil gets kind of slippery, and you go to step on your grass and it's a little spongy for a day or two, but then it freezes right back up at the end of February, you know, and I've never tapped historically before the last few days of February, or even the first day of March. This season, it's been much different. I probably could have tapped trees last week and had pretty significant flow, especially the next few days and this coming weekend. They're going to be pretty good. I'm a little bit behind schedule, and I was getting ready to tap this weekend, and I'm looking at Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, it's getting back down into the 20s. So as things happen, you know, it's a little – weather is supposed to be getting a little more unpredictable, and, you know, who knows how we will see those changes, you know, come through. I also know it's a La Nina or an El Nino year, one of the two, which is making for some different weather patterns. Yeah, this one really threw me for a loop because, there was the biggest sap flows that I've seen in the last 10 years in the month of February in the state of Iowa. And, my hope is that it continues through March because, March is usually when I get the best flows. And I think next year I may have to be ready a little earlier.
That's how it always is. It's saying nothing about the ratio of sap to sugar. Or the water to the sugar in your work, it's a lot of work to gather from all of these trees and get everything boiled down. And my goodness, and it's just a lot of work. You have to love it. My goodness, couldn't you just stay inside and watch videos and put your feet up? You know, I mean, this is why do you bother to do this, Ben?
If I knew, I'd probably be doing something else. I don't know why I do it. I guess, you know, this winter for me has been a lot of hibernating, and I'm really excited to get up and start moving and working again. You know, my brain gets working, my body, you know, has been kind of sitting around for a while. You know, I know a lot of folks get excited about gardening season, starting plants, and I'm really excited to get moving even a little bit earlier to take advantage of some of this.
Well, you guys have
the business model is unique.
Yeah, yeah.
No, nobody has described what your sugar making process is like.
Yeah.
Ben does it the traditional way with real firewood. Talk about your setup.
Yeah, like I said, there's a lot of work with this, and you have to kind of plan ahead because you use firewood to boil away the sap. So how much firewood do you need for all of this?
This may be the first year I've cut enough firewood ahead of time to cover the season. Now, I can't be sure because it hasn't started yet, but I maybe have 5 or 6 cords stacked and ready to be burned.
That's a lot.
I'd hope that would get me through the season. Maybe not. But the business model is unique. You know, I live in a place here on the north side of Ames that doesn't have a lot of maple trees on the property. And I guess since I've moved around a lot in the last 10 years, I've kind of had to take a business model for making maple syrup that is one that can be on the road. So if I bring my equipment with me, which are these big flat pans to boil and my filters and my buckets and taps, I would basically end up in a new town, whether I was there for a year or 3 years, and drive around the neighborhoods and knock on people's doors who had maple trees in their yard. And I would basically give them a little elevator speech to say, hey, I see you've got this big, beautiful tree. I'm wondering if I could tap your tree in exchange for giving you a free jar of syrup and inviting you to a little party that I have to show people how maple syrup is made. And I'd say about 80% of the time they're on board with it. So it does make a unique model for collecting sap. So I'm driving around with the sap wagon all late winter, early spring, and we're emptying buckets and transporting, you know, 2,000 pounds of sap every day back and forth, and then turning it into a few gallons of sweet syrup. And it's definitely a labor of love and a great way to build community. And I may actually make some money doing it this year. We'll see. Maybe after 10 years, I've finally got it figured out, but I'm not counting on it.
I have to say Ben's maple syrup, because it's done on an outdoor fire, has a slightly smoky, wonderful depth of flavor to it. So I'm looking forward to this year's batch of maple syrup.
It's always a magic time of the year. Yes, it's. Oh, and I want to mention, Practical Farmers of Iowa is kind of gathering this thing together. There is going to be a maple syrup field day featuring Ben. And on March 12th, do I have that right? March 12th?
Yeah, that rings a bell to me.
Okay, good. Well, you better be there. All right. Anyway, for more information on that, because it's a sign up and the slots are limited, contact practicalfarmer.org. That's their website. Or here's the phone number to find out about that field day, 515-232-5661. That'll be good. You'll learn about that. Yeah, Ben's, you call it community-supported maple syrup, and it is. Ben gets to talk about syrup and teach kids and people about, yes, there are important, wonderful things that just plain grow out of the ground here, and we are very fortunate to live here. Yes, we are.
That's one of my favorite things about the syrup is that, you know, this will be the, gosh, I think the third year that I'll be returning to some of these homes. And, you know, I know some of the kids by name. You know, I haven't seen them in 11 months. And they come running to the door and start shouting, "Ben's here, Ben's here. It's time to make maple syrup." You know, they know how to tap the trees. They know how to check the buckets. You know, they know the whole process. And, you know, no matter how it ends up for me at the end of the year, I just get a really big kick about out of being able to expose folks to new situations.
Good. Well, thank you for being with us today, Ben. We've been talking to Ben Hoch. He has all kinds of wonderful information about outside stuff, and you can find out more at Backyard Sugar. Yes, you can. And to contact Practical Farmers of Iowa, too, if you want to learn more. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We had music today by the Volo Bog Trotters playing Nail That Catfish to a Tree, and we'll go out with some banjo music from Bob Black, keeping with the water and river theme. He's going to play Ladies on the Steamboat. Yes, support KHOI. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had great engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life. Thank you.